This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3097 for Tuesday, the 16th of June 2020. Today's show is entitled Season 1 Episode 7 The Big Blue Button and is part of the series Linux in Laws. It is hosted by Monochromec and is about 65 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, the lads talk to Fred Dixon, product manager for Big Blue Button.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. Season 1, Episode 7. The one with the big blue button. Good morning, Martin. How are things?
Good morning, Chris. I'm well. How are you?
Can't complain.
You
can't
always complain.
Given the fact that it's 9:30 on a lovely Sunday. Sorry, sunny morning. No, it's not Sunday.
Yes. Why is it so early again, Chris?
I don't know. Some people suggested that we should do an early morning slot to.
It's probably because you enjoyed the last early episode so much.
Maybe, I don't know. So, Martin, what's happening?
Yeah, so what's happening? Well, obviously, this is our episode on a big blue button.
We're going to do an interview later on with one of the project leads. But first of all, some news.
The news.
The news, yes, Martin. What's new?
Okay, so my news of the week, news or not news, whatever you want to call it, since the details of this are a little bit lacking, is the fact that EasyJet has been hacked and many accounts have been found, as well as some credit card details. So this is yet another example of a corporation not implementing their security very well. Obviously, BA was the previous example of this airline, another airline which did this. But on this subject, recently running Firefox again after finding Google has some redrawing issues on Ubuntu, it comes up with this standard Firefox monitor as soon as you fire up Firefox for the first time. Which is quite a handy feature, I find, to warn you if you go to certain website that have been hacked in the past and details have been compromised.
Coming back to the EasyJet breach, Martin, what you're going to do with the cash when you have sold the 9 million data sets?
Well, records? I don't think that you read this correctly, because it was very much pointed at our Chinese colleagues. I'm not from Chinese origin.
Well, you see, this is basically where something called virtual private networks come in handy, right?
indeed. on the subject of our friends from the East, similar to when you're running your own servers, they seem to be quite active in the breaking into markets, as you notice when you're running your own servers. But
just because you come from a Chinese IP, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are in China, you know. Maybe
I see you're behind it all.
Maybe these Chinese IPs are just handy or cheap or abundant. I don't know.
Fair point. However, they're also quite active in. They are known to have quite a lot of compute power in China, right? For
they do. In addition to IP addresses, fair enough. Martin, you never fail to surprise me.
Well, do they actually have many IP addresses for the size of the country is the question.
I think a lot of people are living down there, yes.
Do they have a larger range assigned, do we notice?
I do not know.
Something we missed. Anyway, waiting for some more detail on this EasyJet hack, because it's just saying, ooh, it was highly sophisticated, is not very useful for the tech community amongst us who want to know what actually happened. So I find it quite astonishing that these things can happen in 2020 with security experts freely available. One of them being a German colleague of mine.
Well, I'm always tempted to ask Martin to reveal more details about the hack, but given the fact that this is a public podcast, he might be a little bit on the shy side.
Let's not do this. A fine line, right? Presumably, you could make a lot more moolah using the dark side than the.
more than likely. In other shocking news. I just found out what the next Ubuntu version will be called.
21.
And it's, yeah, no, sorry, not 21, but rather 2010, which is the autumn release. And in contrast to what Mark Schottenberg will tell you, it's actually called Martin Wimpress Vanity Edition.
Say that again.
It will be called Martin Wimpress Vanity Edition. And why is this shocking? Because in the past, animal species, in addition to some funny adjectives, is that what I'm looking for? Or traits have been the names of Ubuntu editions. For example, the last LTS is the 2004 and was called Focal Fossa, if I'm not completely mistaken. And the previous one was
E1
something, yes. Ermite?
Yes, Ermine.
Ermine. But Canonical decided to break with that rule, and now the next edition will be called Martin Wimpress Vanity Edition. So Martin Wimpress,
how much did he pay for
Ubuntu podcast fame, if you're listening, this is your edition.
Does he not know this already? And how much did he pay them for this?
Okay. Shedding more light on this, of course, this was a lame joke or pun or whatever. No, actually, the next one will be called Groovy Gorilla. But why am I even mentioning this, Martin Wimpress, if you're listening? You did a great stunt on ubuntupodcast.org or on the Ubuntu podcast rather, because what Martin apparently did, he got in touch with Mark Shuttleworth and suggested Groovy Gorilla, and they had a laugh. They had a way of a time rather on the last Ubuntu podcast, basically slagging Martin off for this. So Martin, this is another opportunity to slack you. We are looking forward to Martin Wimpress Vanity Edition appearing somewhere around September 21st or something. What other news are there?
In other news, yes, where were we? Okay, on a personal news.
You wanted to talk about this breach, and what you're going to do with the cash, Martin.
Well, that's
maybe we covered that already.
Let's not go there. Maybe perhaps make some improvements to Google on Ubuntu. That'd be a good investment.
by the way, before I forget, fun fact, dear listeners, you can actually change, for those of you who are pretty annoyed with the Focal Fossa wallpaper, when you log into a GNOME shell or something like this, you can change this. In contrast, pro tip now, in contrast to the 1910 one, you don't have to change an ASCII file as in a cascading style sheet. It's now wrapped into something called a G-variant database, which you have to change. There is actually a hack on GitHub allowing you to do this via the ETC alternative system. Links will be in the show notes. The way it works essentially is you replace the original G-variant database with something that you have under your control, and then Ubuntu picks this up. And then you can modify the wallpaper. You can also get rid of the Ubuntu logo on the login screen if you choose to do so by simply making the corresponding PNG file that has this name in it, 0 bytes. If you remove it, the GDM will be pretty annoyed. But if you shrink it to 0 bytes, basically the file will be open, GDM will be happy, but the logo, but the Ubuntu logo won't be displayed. Again, details on the show notes. Couldn't resist there. Mark, if you're listening, courtesy of Linux In-Laws.
One of our many listeners, yes, of course. Of course he's listening. Why wouldn't he be listening?
Excellent. Okay, any other news?
Any other news? Yes. Well, it depends.
You wanted to talk about this data breach and what you're going to do with the cache selling the records, no? Sorry, I think we covered that already. Anyway.
There was an age-related DSTS coming up, but I think there is even more call for it now.
Martin still has to rewrite this, dear listeners, so stay put.
Yes.
We must do feedback at some stage, but we can do that after the interview.
It's also going live today, isn't it? So,
we're gonna put this on Hacker Public Radio at some.
I meant the previous one.
Is it today? I thought
21st.
It was.
Oh, it's tomorrow. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Maybe it's tomorrow. I don't know. Yeah, we're recording this on the 20th of May. But you probably won't listen to this before early June on Hacker Public Radio, subject to availability of slots on this beloved website.
I have a question for you, Chris.
Yes.
Hacker Public Radio, do you know what it's actually named after?
A website dedicated to unedited podcasts on anything hacker-related?
Yes and no, but did you know that there is actually a Hacker Radio as a device?
I wouldn't know the technical details. Let's ask the hacker among us, Martin. What is this Hacker Radio thing?
Well, so before the internet, music music and speech was transmitted either by waves in the atmosphere, or by telephone lines, or by physical devices like records and so on, right? Anyway, so
that was the point in time when Martin was around 20 years of age, give or take.
So, yes, so radio being one of these devices that has a recepting capacity for transmitting these wavelengths. Anyway, so being very popular with young people.
Like yourself.
in those days, and not having any digital media available, let alone transport. There were a lot of companies making physical devices to receive these wavelengths, right? So whether it's for television or radio waves and so on. Not radio waves, but you know what I mean. And Hacker was one of these companies who built radios. So...
Interesting. Yes.
And if you put this in your favorite search engine, you will find some examples, or you, I can show you one in my garden.
You have a hacker, are you, in your garden? Okay.
Yes. Well, not in the garden, but in the...
Does that help with breaching airline websites, I wonder?
Well, this is the thing, you see. There's so many people are using the internet that going back to...
I see.
back to analog is much safer.
Full disclosure, Martin is not associated with the EasyJet hack at any time. This is just me making fun of Martin. British police, don't go after him, please. That was just a joke, I think.
I think it's working, yeah. Keep going.
Excellent. There was something I want to talk to you about.
Go for it.
I keep forgetting.
Not again.
So, yes, NVIDIA. NVIDIA.
Our favorite. NVIDIA. I have a comment. Martin, sorry, before you start, I have a comment. NVIDIA, you need to make faster stuff.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yes.
Because training... it doesn't really matter what you're training, right? It's still taking hours rather than seconds. And, you know, we're in 2020 now. I expect better from you. So get cracking on some better hardware, please. Anyway, carry on.
Okay. Martin had some issues with the browser recently where he blamed Chrome for not being able to display certain websites. Maybe, Martin, you can share more details.
No, it's, it's more... not so much not being able to display certain websites. It's when you have it open for a while and maximize and minimize it, change to other things on other applications on Ubuntu, it just becomes a mess and you need to basically resize it or redraw it. It leaves stuff behind, right? It's not refreshing itself very well.
Martin, of course, immediately saw Chrome as the culprit in this context. Whereas I tried to make fun of him by saying, no, look, this may be an NVIDIA problem.
Well,
because as we all know, Martin is running this on his Ubuntu box that has some sort of high-end GTX, what is it, 2070 incorporated,
which
right?
Which is still not very impressive. But anyway, so, I mean, like yourself, presumably. I don't know. How many browsers do you run, Chris?
I
run many browsers. Only Chrome has displayed this
about
two.
Okay. Now the truth, the listeners, may be in the middle in terms of if you take a close look of how Chrome is architected, and this is basically what you see across operating systems. It goes for Windows, Mac, as well as Linux. You'll see that actually Chrome does a lot of things directly on the GPU. There's something for example, on macOS called the Chrome, I think, GPU render or whatever the process is called. So if you're encountering similar issues, take a look at. Ultimately, I would of course recommend taking a look at the Chrome source code, but given the fact that this is quite a few megabytes in size. You may be better off using your search engine because Chrome has a lot of documented as well as undocumented command line switches. Some of them being able to control the GPU directly. If I have the time, you'll find more details in the show notes because Martin brought this up on kind of short notice. I didn't have the time to research this properly, but let me do some digging. You just may be able to fix this using the command line as such. So stay tuned. Mm. I may have an update at a later episode. Martin has already decided to delete Chrome from his hard drive.
It's getting to that stage. Well, when the likes of Firefox and Opera can function without these issues, then why bother, right? So Chrome, you haven't done a very good job. Sorry.
Well, I mean, on the upside, Chrome is one of the fastest browsers I know. And that, of course, directly relates to rendering performance.
Does anybody actually benchmark browsers?
There are a couple of websites dedicated to this. You'll find details in the show notes.
Okay,
I think now is the time to bring on our guest.
Yes.
And let's do the feedback after the interview. First of all, great to have you on the show, Fred. Why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners for those few who don't know you, never mind the Big Blue Button Project yet.
All right. So my name is Fred Dixon. I am the product manager for Big Blue Button, which is an open source web conferencing system for online learning. I have been managing the project for over 10 years, and I am the one responsible for the releases. So if you have good things to say about the product, I'll pass it on to developers. If you have things you want to improve, you can tell me.
Great. Can you share a little bit about your personal project and how you got into computer in the first place?
So let me, I'm a computer scientist by trade, and where I discovered Big Blue Button was at Carleton University here in Ottawa, Ontario. So in an academic environment, it was a project that had been built by a student, a master's student at the Technology Innovation and Management Program at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And so they had built a system all in open source components, and they were using it to teach online. And I was networking around the university looking for students that I could mentor, because I had gotten a lot of mentorship early on in my career. Came across this project and thought, there's something here. Like, open source is a really powerful way to disseminate a product. And then the business model is you can provide services and support, but you have to solve a problem first. And if you do that, and lots of people start using it, then you create a market where you can offer additional value into it. Like, pick any open source software like WordPress or others, right? It's a very, very well-practiced business model. And I thought that for virtual classrooms, this business model would work well, because academia is usually fairly open to trying open source. I mean, even back then, 10 years ago, it was even more so. So fast forward today, as an open source project, we, thanks to the community, we're localized into, I used to say 25 languages, but I'm probably around 35 now.
Wow.
It's used all over the world, every corner. We have tens of thousands of downloads a week, a million plus visitors on our website. The usage of it on our mailing list has just, the messages have skyrocketed. Like, I wake up every morning and there are 100 messages in our developer mailing list. I have a feeling this is what Linus must have felt like in the early days. Like, I can't read them all anymore. Like, you
amazing.
Know.
Yeah, that sounds like a, well, these times, obviously, you're going to be super busy, aren't you? So thank you again for joining us on the show. So it sounded like when you just came across it rather than being involved with the guy who actually started the project himself. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, so Richard Allam, who's the CTO, had been working on it for a year. And in 2007, I kind of met him and we really hit it off. And I said, okay, I think there's something here. And at the time, I was working at another company. So I started a number of companies myself. And I said, okay, I'm going to get 2 years into this. I'm going to give 2 years in towards this project to see if we can get it going as an open source project, provide some hosting, professional services around it, and focus on one market, which is online learning. And I have to say, like, Big Blue Button is used around the world in many different contexts. If you have a core product, which is providing audio, video, slides, chat, screen share, you know, all, you know, record and playback, accessibility, all the core things you expect in any web conferencing system, commercial or not, you know, when you focus on a market, you build on that core and then you extend your features towards a target market. So in Big Blue Button, we built things like shared notes, multi-user whiteboard, breakout rooms. Breakout rooms took us a while, but these were all things that when you want to, you know, challenge people to learn, right? Teachers do not want to stare at a screen and talk into the void. They want students responding to polls, chat, emoji, breakout rooms, you know, raising their hands. They want engagement. So, you know, if you think of a video conferencing system where, you know, 12 webcams come up and you're just talking with each other, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you look at it from a pedagogic point of view, there are more things that could be done. So we decided to focus on building out features on top of a strong core that would be attractive to an educational use case scenario.
Yeah, I can see the benefits of this. Obviously, you know, myself and Chris were regularly doing these kind of sessions for customers with a commercial product, but you don't have the engagement so well as doing these kind of things in person. So it sounds like your like Big Blue Button is actually more suited to these kind of activities. And so education is not really its main use case, I would say.
Presumably, you're finding that with the downloads and the requests is that people are using it for, you know, pure meet, you know, online meetings, user groups, those kind of things.
In all cases, like they're finding that if they're inside of a corporation and they want to set up their own in it, like behind the firewall conferencing system, Big Blue Button provides them an option to do that. If you are doing like one-to-one coaching, you know, and you want to just have a purpose-built application for that, Big Blue Button will allow you to do that. If you want to talk, you know, give online classes, that's the primary focus for Big Blue Button. I can share with you, like, one of the largest deployments of Big Blue Button is actually the U.S. Department of Defense. So they have been running it at scale for over 5 years now. Excuse me. And they call it Defense Information Systems Agency. The Defense Information Systems Agency call it DCS, Distributed Collaborative Systems. And they adopted it. It's not going to sound unsurprising. They adopted it because it was open source. They could scan every line of code. They had full access to everything. And they used it to build an internal system that made available to people in the military. So there's an example of a non-educational use of the product, but the core capabilities of Big Blue Button enabled them to do it.
An interesting perspective there. I'm just wondering, I reckon since this whole pandemic thing broke out globally, your download figures must have skyrocketed. Do you have any indication of what the increase is since more and more people are working from home these days and companies are just going for conferencing solutions beyond the commercial competition out there, like the Teams of the world, like the Zooms of the world and so forth?
So I haven't checked the numbers recently, but while a few weeks ago, there were tens of thousands of download every week. I'm just counting the unique IP addresses on the download server, the package server. So okay, it is far more than it was before. And this is all correlated with, you know, the Twitter traffic, the traffic on our website, the traffic on the mailing list in terms of like the developer mailing list. So Big Blue Button has had a huge deployment. And I will share with you, like, there's a bunch of components that have been released over the years that build kind of more of a complete solution. So a lot of cases, there are four things that people will leverage. If let's say they're using Moodle. There's a Moodle plugin that's available. Mm-hmm. There are currently 1,400 plugins available on the Moodle database. They rank the top 20 by popularity, like downloads in the last 12 months. The Big Blue Button plugin ranks at number 3. And I think it's going to take over the number 2 spot in probably a couple more weeks. So a huge number of people are using Moodle. There's Big Blue Button itself, which is open source. And then there's two other components that people are leveraging. One is if you don't have Moodle, you still want kind of a simple front end that lets you log in, create a room, invite people to the room, and then after your meeting's done, see the recordings and manage the recordings. So we built a front end called Greenlight. The idea is like Greenlight is giving you, you know, a very simple front end that you could log in with OAuth if you're Office 365 or Google Apps, or you create your own accounts. It's a Ruby on Rails application.
I see.
The other open source component is something called ScaleLight. And so 2 months ago, we worked with Sijo Liverpool University in China, and they were using Moodle, and COVID-19 had struck. So they needed to be able to host Big Blue Button at scale. And what we did was we built out a load balancer for them. So they could take a pool of 15 Big Blue Button servers and to Moodle, make it look like a single Big Blue Button server.
Nice. Okay.
So with Greenlight as a front end, ScaleLight to manage a pool of Big Blue Button servers and make it look to, let's say, Greenlight or Moodle as a single server, and ability to have like a pool of Big Blue Button servers in the back end. All the pieces are there that if a school or university or organization wants to run Big Blue Button at scale, they can do it. And so I was chatting with some folks earlier this week. This is in Germany. They had set up Big Blue Button at scale with over 600 servers using these open source components. And they did, they did not have to talk to us. They basically went through the docs, joined our mailing list. And that was fantastic, amazing, because that was our goal. Every student in the world should have access to a high quality online learning experience. we, as an open source project, create tools to enable instructors to engage their remote students. We have created the most popular web conferencing system for online learning, which is BigBlueButton.
Nice. Okay. Just because you just mentioned Germany, fun fact, I'm German by birth, and I see a particular uptake here in this country. For example, I'm helping to organize FrostCon, which is one of the biggest community events in any given year here in Germany. And this year, unfortunately, we had to decide to move this to virtual. So we're using a BigBlueButton instance, not only for hosting the conference in August, but also for all of the prep work. So as a matter of fact, tonight, we have the next OCC team meeting using a BigBlueButton instance. Do you see a particular uptake in Germany now that you mention that? Or is it just kind of across Europe, across the world? Or are there any other countries, specific countries, where you see a particular strong uptake?
So let's talk about Germany for a moment. Definitely we see a strong uptake. I mean, you can look at the Twitter feeds. If you look at just searching Twitter for any tweet that has the word BigBlueButton, I have to learn German because half of them are in German now. I mean, Twitter will translate it for me.
But okay.
There is a tremendous amount. And part of this comes back to data privacy. So okay. Like we as a Canadian company, we don't have any legal status in Germany. There's no German mm-hmm. arm of us. So, but as an open source project, the opportunity is there for German-based organizations, like the one I mentioned earlier that set up over 600 servers, to fully leverage BigBlueButton. So because it's open source, and because you have access to all the code, and because the tools are there to host it at scale, we see very large-scale deployments now occurring, and a lot of them are occurring in Germany. And we, again, think this is fantastic, because we're getting a ton of feedback on the product and ways that we can improve it. And let me just say up front, right, your listener may be asking, well, is Fred going to say BigBlueButton is a secure system now? Or does it fully support GDPR? You know, and pick any other criteria. And as a manager of open source projects or the maintainer, I would say, like, if anyone in the world tells you their system is secure, they are lying to you, because it's just levels of security. And we try very hard to make it secure. And there's information on our website and all the things we do in terms of the encrypted data, information going back and forth and so on. In terms of support for the General Data Rights Protection Act, we have things which we do in terms of, like, you can turn off recordings. There's more things that we can do. And our community has been actually helping us put together some documentation. If you go to the docs.bigbluebutton.org, and there's a document there for privacy. And this is an evolving document in terms of, okay, you want to support GDPR or privacy, here are the things that BigBlueButton collects, and here is the way to reduce that. And this is awesome, because we are getting other people to contribute their skills and expertise. Like, we're developers, but when you work with the community, things just happen so much faster. So a lot of things is happening when you know readers listen to this, or the listeners listen to it. You know, it'll probably be further along than it was, you know, at the point of time we recorded it. But with regards to Germany, yes, a huge increase, partly because I think we do a pretty good job of, you know, the conferencing part, especially for online learning. It is fully open source. The pieces are there to run it at scale. There's active work in terms of making sure that we do the best possible support for GDPR. And there's a community of people around the world who have been working with BigBlueButton for many years. We all share a commonwealth of every improvement to BigBlueButton has a multiplicative effect now that everybody using it gets to benefit from it. So whether you're an educational institution, whether you're a not-for-profit or commercial company, if you're building on BigBlueButton, the opportunity is there to fully leverage it and engage with the community and contribute back.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that was one of my questions, is kind of, you know, how is your project organized, and do you get more collaboration from external parties that you didn't have before? It looks like you have a set of core developers, right, that seem to look after the project, but do you get more contributions nowadays?
Yes, we do. We have guidelines we wrote up years ago in terms of, like, how to send us pull requests, how to contribute, how to interact. And we, more and more now, we get people in our community sending us pull requests to improve parts of the product. And that's amazing because we care a tremendous amount about the usability of the product, making sure that it's easy for instructors and students to get in, the stability of the product, all these things around it. And now when other people contribute, that's just amazing because now we can see the product accelerating faster and faster, and things that we normally would have to do ourselves, if other people can take a shot at it, we can review it. It's less work for us. They have a vested interest in it, and the project just goes just
faster. That's the whole idea behind it, isn't it? Do you have a commercial company as well that looks after, for example, commercial versions of Blue Button? Like many open source projects, there are usually the enterprise version, don't speak. I can imagine that compared to people that use Teams or Zoom or whatever, they might want to go with proprietary or supported versions of a piece of software, right? So,
right. And so there are a number of companies that are in the Big Blue Button ecosystem. You'll find them listed at bigbluebutton.org. I work at one of them as well. And they're all providing hosting for Big Blue Button to various parts of the world. That list was probably going to grow over time. But yes, when I decided to go for the open source business model with myself and my co-founder, I looked a lot at why other open source projects fail, and they fail because they don't make money. So we have tried very hard to offer, hosting and support, and that model has worked for us over the years, and has worked for many other companies involved in the Big Blue Button ecosystem. So there are options for commercial support that you can find at bigbluebutton.org. Just click on commercial support. Mm-hmm. And companies are there. So another interesting question comes up is people ask, where can I donate money to the project? Okay. And we're very clear on this in our documentation. We do not accept donations. I think it's a silly way to run an open source project because it implies that you're working for charity. If you are a commercial organization, government entity, and you want to make use of Big Blue Button and you want to be supporting the project, go to one of the companies that provides commercial support and buy a support contract from them or buy some hosting. Much of that revenue goes right back into improving the product. The company makes revenue, you get support or hosting. The resources available to companies grow because they're making more revenue. Like, it all works out. So we really believe strongly in the social benefit of what we're doing. And it's just so pleasing to see people tweet screenshots. I'm in South Africa and, we set up Big Blue Button and now we can able to teach students in remote villages. Like, oh my God, that makes us all feel so good. And we also believe in the entrepreneurial opportunities of, taking something that we've built, making it available under open source license, and then going back to the community and saying, hey, if you want hosting, we can do this for you. Like, you have the option of setting it up yourself at scale, but for many organizations, they would rather have someone else do that for them. And that's where the companies can help out.
Of course. Yeah, it makes sense, right? And so how do you see the obviously it's accelerating at the moment, so how do you see going forward the future of the project, to speak?
So the way I think of it is this: there are commercial options out there, and there is nothing that a commercial option is doing that we can't eventually get to as a project. So I see the capabilities of Big Blue Button, the core capabilities strengthening over time in terms of scalability and other areas. Right. And I also see us deepening our value proposition for the educational market, because I'm not trying to outbeat the competitors at their own game. That's a kind of a fool's errand. I've learned enough from, entrepreneurism that you focus on a market, provide really good value for that market, and then you grow from that market. And to be honest, the educational market is huge. Like, with COVID-19, yes. Like,
even bigger.
It is way beyond what any one company could do. So when I see instances of Big Blue Button setting up that are running 600 servers to support like large scale educational needs, I think that's it. That's exactly what we were trying to do. So I see that every time we improve with each iteration, with each improvement, our value proposition for online learning gets stronger and stronger. And again, that's the winning strategy from my experience, is to focus on a market, add value. And in terms of you know, with the educational market, there are some, every university or college has a learning management system. Mm-hmm. Like it's Moodle or it's Canvas or it's Genzibar or it's Schoology, you know, or it's Blackboard or it's D2L. Like there's, and then there's like just dozens and dozens of others around the world. Moodle is the dominant one worldwide, not so much in North America. So we have focused a lot of engineering resources into making sure the integrations with the learning management systems are deep. And it's a very easy for an instructor and students to get together and click, you know, one link, and then you're into a virtual class, you collaborate, you go back, you leave. And in the LMS, the recording there is visible for, you know, some short time afterwards.
Yeah.
And that ease of use, again, reflects how much we're focusing on that market. So, you know, ease of integration, engagement, and over time, analytics, so that we can get back into, okay, like Moodle is an example. Like we're close to an updated feature, which is telling you, which will be able to tell the instructor with activity completion, you know, they could mark an activity as being, okay, mark this activity as being completed, like telling Moodle, okay, Moodle, mark this as completed when the students have spent more than 2 hours in an online class, right? So you have a couple classes, the time is going back into Moodle, and at some point the activity threshold is reached, and then Moodle says, okay, the students have completed this activity, like check. And nice. So that you get there when you really focus on in integration, and we do a lot of that.
That's a good strategy. Sorry, Chris, carry on.
Interesting perspective, indeed. Switching gears now a little bit, I noticed that the software is licensed under lesser GPL. Can you explain a little bit about the background for that decision and the implications on contributors?
Right. So the LGPL version 3 was a good enough license when we started the project 10 years ago. And like we're, you know, we could change it because we have contribute agreements signed for all the code that's been committed to the project. So the Big Blue Button Inc., the legal entity, owns the code and has agreements with all the contributors, myself and everyone else. So we do have the option, the Big Blue Button Inc., which is a not-for-profit legal entity incorporated in the province of Ontario. You know, the license could be changed if we want. So we wanted something that was very permissive, and LGPL was as good. There may be a world where we get to where it's the Apache public license, which allows you even more freedom. The only place that this really kicks in is LGPL. This requirement is that you must be able, if you're linked in, it's basically the lesser GPL. If you get linked in to a product through the LGPL, that product must be able to run standalone without. Otherwise, it's not really a component. It's like the product. Mm. So the only part the LGPL is a little tricky is if you're one of the parts is if you're going to build mobile apps, because the mobile apps are basically built in, and then it's really hard to meet all the criteria of the LGPL because of the way the vendors like the App Store and others digitally sign and encrypt the app. So it's not something that you can pull apart and run without it. If you do the Apache public license, you're able to do that. It turns out in the early days, we looked at building a mobile app for Big Blue Button, but because of Apple's support for WebRTC, and obviously Chrome has good support, Big Blue Button just runs as a single page web app. There is no app to install. And
I see.
You can run it on the latest like iPhone, iOS 12.2 and above, or Android 6.0 and above. You could go to demo.bigbluebutton.org with your phone and just launch into a session. And you can see the audio, you can see the video, you can see the screen. There's only a few limitations, one of which is you cannot share your screen on a mobile device, but not something you really need to do a lot of anyway. But it was huge for our project because it meant that we could focus on a React-based interface. So it's the front end is all JavaScript, all HTML5, using React to manage all the layout and UI updates. And we built it with a mobile first plan so that if you open it up on an iPad, an iOS, Android tablet, it will work. And it was a responsive interface. So it's the same code that's running on the desktop, laptop, Chromebook, tablet, phone. And in that regard, the LGPL license is still working fine for us.
Interesting, yes. Just wondering, last question on licensing from my side. Did the LPGL help with plugin development in terms of, if I want to contribute code, I have to sign a CLA, fine. But then if I want to keep this closed source, I can do so by not contributing the code, right?
Exactly. So the code for BigBlueButton is, like, we didn't choose the Afero, the AGPL, which is a very It's a very, LGPL is very permissive. So yes, if you, as long as there's no distribution event, and that's the key thing, as long as you're running code on your servers, as long as you're not distributing the code elsewhere, you're fine. You can modify it, right? This is what Google does. They just take open source, they run it on Google servers. There's no distribution event that's triggered, so they don't have to disclose the source. So in that regard, you're great. Like, you could take it internally as a, you know, as a commercial company, you could take this internally, you could brand it, modify it, the license, you're on side with the license. You just can't put it up in a repository and distribute the code to someone else, because you can't take away the rights that you got to the code. You can't take those rights away from someone else if you distribute a derivative work based on BigBlueButton. So any extensions that you would make to the product, you know, you must provide full access to the source code under the terms of the LGPL to someone that you give the code to, whether you're, you know, giving them on a CD, or you transfer it on a USB stick, or you know, make it available for download on the internet. And that's what open source is about, right? It's access, the right to see the code, the right to make changes. And, you know, I think pretty much everybody respects it, you know, and it's not something I've worried about. Like, there's just so many people contributing to the project. There is a little confusion sometimes. Like, can people call it BigBlueButton? Can they use our logo? No. Like, you have to be very, we have trademark guidelines, because the copyright to the logo, the trademark to the logo is different than the copyright to the code. And, but again, most of the times when you see BigBlueButton, it's like an official BigBlueButton from the project. And when you see it listed on websites, a lot of people will attribute to that, hey, BigBlueButton is, you know, this website is not endorsed by or promoted by BigBlueButton Inc. BigBlueButton and the BigBlueButton logo are trademarks of BigBlueButton Inc.
Yeah.
And they link back to our website, which is what you want.
Hmm.
Okay. Makes sense. I think Chris set up his own BigBlueButton as well for his user group. But how did you end up with Ubuntu to start with? And do you have any plans to look at other Linux versions?
So I maintain the packaging for BigBlueButton, and right. Ubuntu was the default one that we chose like 10 years ago, and we're still doing it. You will probably start to see BigBlueButton on other platforms. We made the choice for doing Ubuntu and only Ubuntu for the following reason. It is a lot to package BigBlueButton. There's lots of components, a lot for the resources we had then, and even lesser so now. But going back in time, there was like, okay, how can we do this? And we had two choices. We could focus on a Linux distribution and do a really good job, or we could try to support two or more distributions and maybe not do such a good job in any of them. And we chose quality over quantity. And what that meant was we just focused on making sure that if you have Ubuntu 16.04 now, soon to be 18.04, you got a really good chance that you got a good install. And then if people were posting to the forums, we knew what they were trying to do, as opposed to, you know, we're not the experts in Arch Linux or Fedora or Red Hat or, you know, CentOS or Ubuntu. We focused. But you may see it other distributions in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, if you have limited resources, you focus on one. But the obvious question would be the Fedoras, the CentOSes, the Red Hats. Really, is that next? I guess. Or I mean, I don't know if you have any direct plans for this. But,
I will say the probably thing, which is like we have desires. we have plans, but we don't have
a long-term roadmap or something.
Yeah. The mantra in our project is we release on quality, not dates. Right. So we never give a date for anything, because, you know, I could tell you this feature will be available, you know, we'll ship it whatever next Monday, and then you'll be like, great, it got shipped on time. does it work, right? Like, you don't really care about the time, you care about, does it work? Like, is this feature going to work now? And we always land on making sure the features and the product works.
I get it. People, you heard it here first. Fedora is definitely on the cards. It's just a matter of when. Okay. jokes aside, Fred. When I looked at the GitHub issues, I saw the request for 18.04, which is the last. The LTS before the last one. With the new version of BBB, any timelines for this in terms of anticipated timelines when you think it's ready? I think you entered alpha testing with this.
So we've actually been building it for 18.04 internally now for months.
Okay.
So when COVID-19 hit, it became clear that we wanted to do some things in the current version of BigBlueButton in response to the overwhelming demand. So we've been iterating on the current version of BigBlueButton a bit longer than we had expected. Just because there was so much that we wanted to do and needed to do. But the next version is building. It's on 18.04. Our goal is to get it out earlier as, like, I call it an early beta. Like, the features won't be finished, but we would rather see a lot more people use it earlier on and give us feedback on it. And the idea is we're not going to put something out there. So the offsetting criteria is we're not going to put something out there that just obviously doesn't work. So we are going to iterate it internally to the point where when someone tries it out, it may not have all the features we want, but they have a good experience. There's no sense to put something out there and people say, well, these 10 things are broken. Okay, we can figure that out and fix it first, and maybe people have to wait a bit longer. But again, it comes back to, you know, when you try something out, you kind of want it to work. It's nice to get things early, but we're not communicating to anybody a date for the next release. We're just expressing that we are working on it. Our goal in the project has always been to put out quality releases. And even if we call something an early beta, we still have a desire to make sure that, you know, the things that you can do in the product work. One of the highest compliments we got years ago was there was another open source project for the conferencing. And someone said, look, I've tried both projects. This other project has more features, but it was very easy to find something that didn't quite work right. Your project, you have less features, but everything seems to work. And that made us feel very good because that's what we were trying to do.
Okay. Martin, did you have a final? I'm just worried about, I'm a little bit cautious on time.
I had one final question really, which was, you've been doing BigBlueButton for 10 years, I guess, something along those lines. Is there something you will be doing for the foreseeable future, or are you thinking of doing something else altogether?
No, we're just getting started. Like, the the critical mass has occurred, right? The goal is to leverage the worldwide interest in what we're doing and allow the project, enable the project to continue to grow. And through that growth, again, the entrepreneurial opportunities and the social benefit, both of those can be realized. And I just think with the amount of interest in the project and the need for it, there's nothing else that we would rather be doing right now is just growing BigBlueButton.
Okay. That was a very interesting final statement, Fred. We would really like to thank you for being on the show.
Yes.
Much appreciated. Needless to say, the word will be spread, not only in Germany, but to all the people we talk to, because, as I said, we run it ourselves, just a great system. And thank you very much for bringing it to life.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you as well.
Thanks very much.
Okay, yeah. Okay, Martin. The interview with Mr. Dixon from project called BigBlueButton. What do you make of it?
Brilliant. No, it's what I like about it is really the approach that they've taken here is the quality first one, making stuff work. And yes, people are asking for, oh, can we have it on Ubuntu 18, 19, 20, this, that, the other. But I like the, with these kind of softwares, you just want it to work, right? You may have to install an older version of Ubuntu on a VM or whatever, but making it work is a good mantra. Having seen the opposite as well, right? As we do in other project where it takes ages to get something up and running because it's kind of
And of course, we have a worldwide exclusive first now because people, you heard it here first. It's going to come to Fedora and CentOS. Yes, just a matter of time.
Where were we?
We still have to do feedback.
Feedback,
Mr. So let me dig up feedback because there was a very interesting feedback posted as a comment, if I'm not completely mistaken, on Hacker Public Radio, the website that we use to publish the show. And a comment by Bendy dating back to the 12th of May regarding the previous episode reads, "Wow, I didn't realize Skynet was really NVIDIA. I'm going to bin my graphics card right now. Thank you so much for this heads up. Bendy, anytime." Stay put.
I would say, just send it to me, right? I'm happily have a few more NVIDIA cards. Apparently, Google are running low on them as well at the moment, so you may make some money out of it.
Martin, of course, isn't impressed by this revelation, but hey, what can I say? And I think, but we have
there was another feedback. Yes.
Yes. Do you want to read this?
If I can find it, bear with me. Do a break. Commercial break.
Commercial break. Okay. Break.
Wait, man, I have to find it first.
Virginia.
Right. Virginia.
At gmail.com.
Right.
So now we're back from the break.
Back from the break. Right. Feedback from Virgie. Which reads, "Hi there, I wanted to reach out to tell you how much I appreciate linuxinlaws.eu, and I especially love the open source resources you mentioned there. One thing that I found out was that lwn.net on your page here, linuxinlaws.eu, and it really provided some interesting insight. Digging into it a bit more, I found this helpful guide in the show notes. It really helped me to better understand open source software as a whole. I think it would be a nice addition to your page, especially for all your users. Thanks again for the great resource. All the best, Virgie."
Virgie, thank you very much for that feedback. As I already said in my mail, we're working on completing the website. So yes, any feedback, and that goes not only to Virgie, but also to any other listeners that there are out there, any feedback on the show, its format, and needless to say, also on linuxinlaws.eu is appreciated. Any comments for Hacker Public Radio? Yes, they have their own mailing lists, so feel free to get in touch with them there. What's missing, Martin?
Still sponsors. Sponsors are missing.
Sponsors. Yes, we're going to do that actually as part of the commercial break after the show. So as usual, stay put. Just before the very valuable outtakes, we're going to have a short sponsor. Let me work on this. It's probably not going to be the White House or Skynet this time around. But as I said, let me work on this. But there's still something missing, Martin, namely the POX of the week. So,
yes,
so what is your POX of the week? Or what are your POX of the week?
I'll just go with one, which is a... by the way, sorry, before I forget this, did you cut down the 30-second pause interval so that people get the outtakes a bit quicker?
Of course.
Okay, just
your
checking.
Wish. Right. Your wish is my command, as usual. Whether it's going to be 20 seconds, 25 seconds, doesn't matter, as long as it's under 30. Consider it done, my dear Martin. No worries.
Thank you.
You're
right, my picks of the week. Right, picks. So one movie I watched, which I liked and disliked for different reasons. It's called Ready Player One. Basically, people living in the future, living inside a video. Well, not living inside a video game, but they escape to the video game world because the world is a mess, as even more of a mess than it is now. So the concept is really nice, and the creator of the this virtual world expires and sets a challenge, go find his Easter eggs, and my company will be yours, etc. Anyway, so I liked it because of the idea that, even though, it's just a basic video game kind of mantra, that you can escape the real world if it's a bit rubbish. And they've taken that to the next level, right? So people can have interactions in virtual reality gone more real, right?
But yeah, the execution was a bit poor. So good and bad. Good for its idea, bad for its simplicity, really.
There was a similar movie about a female game designer entering her own game, but I can't remember. It's ages ago.
Yes, I mean, there's obviously been the likes of Tron and
yeah, but that's what I'm probably... That's not what I'm meaning. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll come back. If in that case, I'm going to put it in the show notes. My POX of the week is actually two books. One is called He's Back. Essentially, picture a guy called Adolf Hitler. I'm not sure if the name rings a bell. He was some weirdo in the last century. Caused a little bit of havoc in Europe, which led to some minor conflict.
You may want to mention he's Austrian as well.
Yes, he's Austrian, not German. Just in case there's a confusion. A very funny book. You'll find the title, including the author, in the show notes. He's Back describes his exploits when he wakes up after the turn of the century in central Berlin and just wondering what the fuck happened. The book goes on that he meets actually the proprietor of a little shop and then gets into politics, all very funny. In case you're into that sort of thing, get the audio version of the book. The book itself is great, but the audio version is even better. A guy called Christoph Maria Herbst, I think is the name, does a really, really great Austrian accent with him. It's absolutely marvelous. Don't miss it.
Sorry, is this in German, the audiobook, or is there an English
version? I think you can get an English version as well.
Okay.
Certainly, you can get the paper version in English because it has been translated because it was that successful. Difficult one. Okay, second POX is actually The Kangaroo Chronicles. It also it describes the exploits of a communist kangaroo sharing a flat with a comedian also in kind of Berlin. And the fun stuff that they experienced, that book has just been turned into a movie, also very funny. And the author, of course, is Mark-Uwe Kling, in case anybody is wondering about this. And I think you can get it also in English, Martin, if you have a chance to check it out. Any anti-poxes this week, or should we close the show?
No, I think it's going to be a long one anyway, right, with the interview. So
yeah. There's one last, I do have an anti-pox. It's called audio on Linux for a number of reasons. but yes.
I think it's probably going to be a recurring theme, isn't it?
I was going to say, this may be a recurring pox or anti-pox of the week, yes. Leonard, if you're listening, please do get in touch. We have some suggestions for the next version of Pulse Audio. Other than that, No, don't get me wrong. It's a great system. Don't get distracted by the naysayers. Same goes for System D. We love these pieces of software. And before people now get up to sending me death threats to, my address is /dev/NULL. So any hate mail, please, send it there. Any other constructive criticism as feedback, we do love and welcome feedback at feedback@ linuxinlogs.eu. That's also the name of the website we are running for the show. And needless to say, you will find us for the time being on Hacker Public Radio, a great community website hosting our show. We have now reached a full episode status. What's what I'm looking for? A full show status. So we do have our own RSS feed on Hacker Public Radio. Ken, thank you very much for doing this. Much appreciated. You find the link in the show notes. And with that, Martin, see you next time around.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Solid Market, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts. Thank you. upon the request of a very special co-host of the show, the outtakes have been brought in by approximately 7.25 seconds. Hope you enjoyed, Martin.
Okay. Pox, shit, doesn't matter. Okay.
Ah, it was quite long anyway.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, yes. Yeah. We do the pox ourselves. No worries.
Yeah.
And we still have to do feedback, Mr. Visser. How are you stuck for time?
Feedback? Do we have feedback?
Yeah, of course we do have feedback.
Oh, the one.
No, two, the three.
All right.
Okay, let's keep on rolling.
Okay, okay.
No breaks. Just go ahead. I'm a little bit sad about Arch because that's my favorite distribution. But hey, you have to cut your losses somewhere anyway. is that what I'm looking for? Probably not. Doesn't matter anyway. Sorry,
we got altogether. End, yeah. Are you not an Arch maintainer?
Yes, I am. We got to edit this
take
out.
Take up a different hobby. Yeah.
Okay.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.